First of all, thank you, Judge Brennan. It's a real honor to appear today, and thank you everyone for coming. I've known many of the panelists for many years, and I'm just really thrilled to be here. I'm also particularly flattered that my former administrative law professor, Gary Lawson, has chosen to spend a few of his valuable minutes with us today. I learned everything I know about administrative law from Professor Lawson, and his lovely bride and my classmate, Patty Granger Lawson, is here also. So thank you for attending. I'm going to speak very briefly about three general topics. One is the big picture of what's happening in the federal courts right now, including the Supreme Court, but also the federal courts of appeals and district courts with respect to what I regard as a sea change in how the courts are looking at executive branch action, agency action. And then secondly, I'm going to talk about, in addition to the major questions doctrine, I think a related doctrine, which is the revival of the non-delegation doctrine. And then finally, a couple of examples about Justice Department regulations and the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission. On the big picture question, I think what we're seeing now is we have a working majority, roughly a 6-3 majority at the Supreme Court, and many Court of Appeals judges and district judges throughout the country who are now looking at the structural constitution, that is the separation of powers, as a mechanism to adjudicate challenges to agency authority, and thinking of the structural constitution, that is the separation of powers between Articles 1, 2, and 3 primarily, as a mechanism by which the founders created a government designed both to have a federal government that is powerful enough to do what it needs to do, that is protect us from invasion, for example, but is also a government of limited and enumerated powers that are separated for the protection of liberty in this country. And I think that's what, in my view, that's what West Virginia versus EPA is all about, among other things. Article 1 of the Constitution vests the legislative power in one body, that is in the Congress. It creates the House and the Senate. It does not vest legislative power at all in in federal agencies. And so what we have is we have a Congress created of enumerated legislative powers, only those legislative powers that are vested, that are mentioned in Article 1 of the Constitution. There is no other legislative power granted anywhere to anybody in the federal government. Yet, we have this a mechanism called the Code of Federal Regulations, Notice and Comment Rulemaking, where the courts have recognized what are called legislative rules. And so the Supreme Court, as recently as 2015, for example, noted that rules issued through notice and comment process are often referred to as legislative rules because they have the force and effect of law. So it's an interesting and bizarre to me, at least, construction of the separation of powers to think that all of the legislative power, and even then the enumerated legislative power that the Constitution vests in one body, the Congress, yet at the same time, legislative rules that have the force and effect of law can be enacted by administrative agencies to impose legal obligations on millions and millions of people throughout the country. And I think we're now seeing, I think, a return to, through originalism, through judicial decision-making of the 6-justice majority that decided West Virginia, a new skepticism, and I think a healthy skepticism, at what administrative agencies are doing. And I think it's a related issue in two ways. One, I think, in terms of both the major questions doctrine and the non-delegation doctrine, the Supreme Court now has at least signaled that it's interested in reviving the non-delegation doctrine, a doctrine that has been dormant since 1935. There are now 5 justices who have signaled that they are interested in bringing that doctrine back, and as well as 6 justices who in the recent term endorsed the major question doctrine. The upshot of that is, we have now what appears to be, I think, at least a 5 or 6 justice majority of the Supreme Court that is essentially concerned about whether or not the Congress of the United States is acting irresponsibly in its view when it simply enacts generally worded statutes that then hand off enormous amounts of legislative power to executive agencies. At the same time, we have executive agencies that simply are frustrated that they can't, or as a policy matter, persuade Congress to do what they want, or what, as a policy or political matter, the president wants them to do. So they scour the U.S. Code, they find generally worded statutes, and they invent new regulatory theories to justify taking over large swaths of the economy or enumerated rights or things of that sort. In a case in 2019, a case called Gundy versus United States, the Supreme Court considered and rejected a non-delegation doctrine challenge to the Sex Offender Registration Notification Act. That was the issue there was that the fact the Attorney General could, by the stroke of a pen, essentially create criminal liability and put people in prison by enacting through regulation an interpretation of the Sex Offender Registration Notification Act for people who are convicted of sex crimes before the enactment of the act. There were four justices in that case who signaled their interest in reviving the non-delegation doctrine. Justice Alito joined the majority opinion at the time to say that he would not do it in this particular case, but that he was open to reviving the non-delegation doctrine. Justice Gorsuch, joined by Chief Justice Roberts and Justice Thomas, went on at length in dissent about how the non-delegation doctrine should be brought back and should have applied in this case and is critical to liberty and separation of powers properly understood. And then Justice Kavanaugh later, in a dissent from denial of certiorari, signaled his willingness to look at it, gave approving language to Justice Gorsuch's dissent in the Gundy case. Justice Barrett was not on the court at the time. But I think it's very clear, at least to me, that given the right vehicle, the right opportunity, the court is very likely to bring that doctrine back. And if and when it does, I think it will be a sea change in terms of both how Congress enacts statutes and how executive agencies, through cabined by the major question doctrine and other provisions of the Constitution that the courts are now looking at as to whether or not the agency action is lawful, that is, whether it's constitutional. We had, for example, very recently, the Fifth Circuit determined that the CFPB, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, is essentially wholly out of business, according to that court, because the funding mechanism violates the apportionments clause. For lawyers who are litigating cases, I would encourage you, and I'm going to talk about the Justice Department and the EEOC here quickly, but to consider rethinking about how you're looking at agency action if you're litigating either against an agency or your client has some kind of agency-related problem. The Supreme Court earlier this week, for example, it considered a challenge about whether pre-enforcement actions can be brought in federal court to challenge agency authority, a decision to come probably at the end of the term. At the Justice Department, I'll give one example of this. The Justice Department enforces Title VI of the Civil Rights Act of 1964. In 2001, the Supreme Court determined that the prohibitions of the statute are limited to intentional race, color, and national origin discrimination. However, the court indicated there's this regulation on the books that addresses disparate impact discrimination under Title VI. The court did not reach the question in the 2001 decision, a case called the Sandoval decision, because that wasn't at issue in the case, but it said expressed skepticism of that. The Justice Department then responded to that decision saying that the regulation is entirely valid. I'm skeptical that this court now, would, having looked at that, would say, wait a minute, we have a regulation that interpreting a statute that says that the disparate impact discrimination is illegal when the Supreme Court in the Sandoval case said that the prohibitions of statute are limited to intentional discrimination, and the court said, that means that disparate impact discrimination is expressly permitted by the statute. There's a rulemaking grant in Title VI to the executive branch of government that authorizes executive branch agencies to issue rules, regulations, or orders of general applicability in order to effectuate the provisions of Section 601 of Title VI, which is limited to intentional discrimination. So this is an example, I think, of either the court, I think, would be, this regulation, in my view, would be vulnerable. It's not been challenged. And the Justice Department right now, by the way, is quite aware of this issue. It was an issue when I served there about what to do with this. But the Justice Department is aware of this. I think there is a close to zero chance this regulation will survive judicial review if it's challenged. There is no private right of action for disparate impact Title VI claims, and so we're limited to Justice Department litigation. The Justice Department has been very shy about using this because they're aware of the vulnerabilities of the regulation. Major questions doctrine, I think, may apply. Not entirely clear how broadly that doctrine will apply. Certainly a Chevron challenge could be brought as well. And again, a non-delegation doctrine challenge could be brought as well because of the generally worded nature of the statute in terms of the rulemaking delegation. At the EEOC, there is a similar problem, in my view, with the Age Discrimination Employment Act. That is a statute that the Secretary of Labor drafted in the mid-1960s to arrogate to himself broad rulemaking power. It is one of the few, if only, statute I can think of where the grant of rulemaking authority is so broad, so vaguely worded, that the only limits are the Secretary can enact whatever now the EEOC, by the way, it's transferred over there. The EEOC can enact any regulation or exemption from the prohibitions of the statute if the EEOC concludes that it's necessary to enforce the law, it's reasonable, and it's proper. Those are the only limits. I think that kind of delegation, I think, is highly suspect if and when the Supreme Court revives non-delegation. I don't think it would be challenged under major questions. And then I'll finish with one reference to a case called State of Texas versus EEOC, which was decided only about a month ago, Northern District of Texas. In 2021, the EEOC issued a technical assistance document about the protections against employment discrimination based on sexual orientation and gender identity. That document was issued by the chair of the EEOC on acting on her own, sub-regulatory, no notice and comment procedures. State of Texas sued. District Court found that the EEOC violated the Administrative Procedure Act by not going through notice and comment rulemaking, violated the Civil Rights Act of 1964, Title VII itself, when it essentially, number one, and even it issued the document because the EEOC lacks substantive rulemaking authority. The rulemaking grant of authority under Title VII is limited to procedural regulations. And in addition, there is one provision of Title VII that says that the EEOC can issue technical assistance guidance if a person requests and pays for the cost of the guidance. And because no one requested it and nobody paid for it, the government violated Title VII in that way. This decision, if upheld and if sustained, did not squarely address or mention either major questions or the non-delegation doctrine. It didn't really need to, but it's indicative, I think, like the Fifth Circuit's decisions about the CFPB, of an increasing skepticism that the courts are taking. Here we have, the EEOC has been issuing sub-regulatory guidance and even notice and comment rulemaking for over 50 years, and now we have at least one judge looking at this saying, not only is your sub-regulatory guidance unlawful, but you violated the law even doing this. Here are the 10 different ways that the government violated law in doing it. And the district court was so angry that it sua sponte awarded attorney's fees to the state of Texas for the government's violation of the law. So with that, I'll leave it and turn it over to my colleagues.
Can you hear me? Okay, yeah. Thanks, Eric. That was a Herculean effort there. You made it easy for me. You set up everything nicely. I'm going to discuss briefly a day in the life at OFCCP for me, I'm going to give you a little backdrop because some of you may not know what OFCCP does as well as some of the civil rights sections or EEOC, unless you are a contractor representing contractors. So briefly, I'll just say that OFCCP is responsible for ensuring that employers doing business with the federal government comply with laws and regulations requiring non-discrimination. It enforces that mission through Executive Order 11246, Section 503 of the Rehabilitation Act of 1973, and the Vietnam Veterans Adjustment Assistance Act of 1974. Together with those three laws, it prohibits the discrimination of employment discrimination based on race, color, religion, sex, sexual orientation, gender identity, national origin, disability, or the status of one's veteran status. In addition, contracts and subcontractors are forbidden from discriminating against applicants or employees because of they inquire about or discuss or disclose compensation. It's worth mentioning I don't care what your views are on the issue, but it's worth mentioning that OFCCP was unique in protecting sexual orientation and gender identity long before the decision in Bostock v. Clayton County, the Supreme Court's decision from Georgia dealing with homosexual or same-sex discrimination. Pursuant to the Federal Properties and Administration Service Act of 1949, the president has the authority to issue policies and directives that promote economy and efficiency in the procurement function of government. And part of that act expresses Congress intended to provide for the government an economical and efficient system for A, the procurement of supplies and personal property and non-personal services. There's been a sharp increase in the use of that act by executive orders, and that increase in the scope of the executive orders relying on that authority. Research demonstrates that Congress rarely takes issue with the actions by these executive orders. However, the policy enacted using that act or the authority of it has created uncertainty and burdens on federal contractors affecting the workforce and the industrial base, and raising concerns about religious nonprofits, charities, businesses, and universities. I would say if you look at the most recent data for industrial bases, they're struggling to deal with the number of these requirements under the executive orders. The vendors for the Department of Defense have fell from 80,000 in 2010 to just over 50,000 in 2019, despite there being a 286% increase in the number of transactions during that period. Even more troubling is the decline of new entrants, falling from a more than 15,000 entries per year to roughly 4,000. When the Department of Defense Industrial Association asked businesses what conditions limited the company's willingness to engage in additional federal contracting, more than 70% cited uncertain business conditions, and nearly 63% cited administrative burdens. Many of those requirements placed on these contractors are based in Executive Order 11246, which under the FETSA Act, which was the purpose of promoting economy and efficiency. I think you have to ask whether Congress intended under that act, if it intended to be used in an expansive way in pushing the policies and interpretations of Executive Order 11246, some of which are burdensome and arguably run counter to economy and efficiency. Executive Order 11246 was signed by LBJ, required non-discrimination based on race, color, sex, natural origin, and hiring and employment in the U.S. government, by U.S. government and contractors. It also requires a contractor to take affirmative actions to ensure that the applicants are employed and that employees are treated during the employment without regard to race, color, national origin, sex. What's a OFCC directive? OFCC directive, I think of it as similar to almost an executive order. The directive provides guidance to OFCCP staff and federal contractors on the enforcement and compliance policies and procedures. A directive, in theory, is not to change the laws or regulations governing OFCCP program and does not establish any legally enforceable right. I'll talk to you about some executive orders and issues that I've been involved in. And one is the TRICARE Directive 2018-02. TRICARE is the health care program that the United States Department of Defense Military Health System. TRICARE provides civilian health benefits to U.S. Armed Forces, military personnel, retirees, and their dependents, including some of the reserves. The summary of that directive is, when I issue that directive allowed military service personnel and their families to seek health care services with local doctors and military facilities, I mean medical facilities, outside of the government contracting sphere and subcontracts. And those health care professionals are allowed to serve them. At the time, and I'll read a part of the that directive. It goes, you know, at this time, OFCCP has determined that it would be beneficial to the and to the national interests and the health of veterans and their families to extend a moratorium to provide additional time to receive feedback from stakeholders. The difficulty of active duty and retired service members and their families have accessing health care is well documented. OFCCP is concerned that continued uncertainty over the extent of the executive order section 503 in VEBRA apply to TRICARE subcontractors has contributed to that difficulty, and that the approaching expiration of a memorandum and a company uncertainty further exacerbate the difficulty. Moreover, OFCCP understands that Congress may enact legislation affecting this area in the near future. And so that's a portion of that directive. Another thing that came across my plate when I was there was just before the Masterpiece Cake Shop case. Several members of the Senate reached out to me regarding their concerns of their constituency, who are religious universities, charities, nonprofits. Some of them from the Catholic charities, Mormon, Baptist, and all sorts of religious organizations were concerned about their ability to contract with the U.S. government. I talked with the members of Congress, and many of these charities and organizations, some who are already federal contractors, some who are interested in being federal contractors, some of them who are doing important research or working with the Department of Defense or other organizations, and were very concerned about the issues, particularly touching on gender, identity, sexual orientation, and what it meant for them as a religious organization and group, and their stance on their employees and whether such behavior was permissible or not with their professors or employees and things of that other nature, and what they could, and whether they could contract with the government if these organizations had some prohibition on that. Masterpiece Cake case hadn't come down yet, and I spoke with senators on this issue and these organizations. After the Masterpiece Cake decision was decided, a directive was issued on that, in light of that decision. I think if you looked at King versus Bednell, the court said that some things are too important to apply the Chevron deference to that case. The major question doctrine holds that there are some you know, things that are important are not eligible for a Chevron review or Chevron deference when looking at the interpretive question, e.g. questions that are politically or economically significant. And so, you know, I want to, you know, put that out to the panel and out to you on the floor on some of these matters, whether, you know, I, some bureaucratic gnome at some agency who was not elected by the people, should be making decisions on such as the TRICARE issue, which is not determining whether former or military people should can get health care, and particularly in rural communities where many military people live. And is that's and you know, my directive placed a moratorium on that nationwide. That, you know, and so it's there's something Marbury v. Madison about that, when you're saying, I'm saying, we're going to allow this or we're not going to allow this. You know, that gives me a certain amount of strength or power to the, you know, that I can't seriously believe that, you know, Congress intended for me to have in that situation. And so some of the things that I want to touch on in the conversation, I'll turn.
Thank you. It's good to be with you all this afternoon. I want to talk a little bit about the NLRB, which is, I think in this context, and I think some folks would argue in other contexts, is a bit of an odd duck in terms of federal regulatory agencies. It's certainly odd in this particular context because, you know, despite the fact that the board has rulemaking authority, from 1935 to 2010, it only exercised that authority on five different occasions. And they were rather, you know, mundane exercises of the rulemaking authority. They were generally about procedural and administrative matters, such as, you know, whether they were to assert jurisdiction over dog racing. Nothing too earth-shattering. About the only pre-2010 regulatory action by the NLRB, rulemaking action, involved the presumptive composition of bargaining units in acute care hospitals. Again, not one that I think raises to major levels. So that, you know, in terms of the actual case itself of West Virginia versus EPA, there's some question. I mean, I think there are certainly undercurrents in the case that are relevant to the NLRB, but don't necessarily fit directly on its adjudicatory model as opposed to a agency that engages in rulemaking. There's one, I think, potential exception to that, and that is a currently pending rule. As I said, there was very little activity until 2010. In 2010 and thereafter, the so-called Obama board issued two regulations, one about requiring employers to post a notice in their place of business detailing employee rights. That was subsequently struck down. They also issued a lengthy regulation changing essentially about 25 or 30 aspects of their representation case procedure. It's largely a procedural kind of regulation internally that was ultimately sustained. But another thing happened during the Obama board that's kind of the setup for the one thing I think that is of some interest in this context with the board. And that is that the board issued a decision in a case called Browning-Ferris Industries, in which it jettisoned probably four decades of board law with respect to the question of whether two entities can be considered as a joint employer of a given group of employees. Until Browning-Ferris issued, the board's view was that unless the two separate companies actually co-determined in a direct an important way wages, hours, and working conditions for the employees who were clearly employed by one of those entities, then they were not joint employers. That changed in Browning-Ferris, and it changed the entire analytical modality was changed in Browning-Ferris, in which a board majority in that case said, no, we're going to look at this in a different way and say, even if the putative joint employer exercises control over the other employee, the other employer's employees indirectly, or even if it only has reserved control over those employees, that may well be enough to deem them a joint employer under the Act. So the problem clearly with Browning-Ferris was that it was extraordinarily vague, and the decision itself had no limiting principles in it. So that you can conceive of this situation, which is typical. I'm a contractor. I hire a subcontractor on a job to do something. And in our business-to-business agreement, I say, oh, by the way, we start work on this job at 8 o'clock in the morning. So I need you to be on the job at 8 o'clock. Well, that affects the subcontractor's employees' hours of employment. Indirectly, maybe, but it does. So is that enough? Well, you know, it's unclear under Browning-Ferris. Similarly, I reserve the right to, I have engaged a temporary agency to bring temporary workers in because I have an uptick in business. And I say, oh, by the way, here's our contract for that. And in that contract, I reserve the right to reject an employee. You send me somebody, and if I don't think they're doing the job right, I don't want you to refer them back here. Even though I never exercise that authority, that is reserved control over the terms and conditions of employer B's employee. So under Browning-Ferris, the argument is that makes me a joint employer. Well, there was obviously in the franchising community, in the subcontracting community, in the temporary work provision community, an uproar over Browning-Ferris. And part of it was generated by the fact that the decision was just so open-ended. The Trump board tried to take that on by engaging in notice and comment rulemaking to establish a rule about how you would determine whether or not two entities were a joint employer. And in very simplistic terms, what they did is they returned to the law that existed before Browning-Ferris and said, look, it's got to be about a major kind of term and condition of employment. It's got to be direct, and it can't be, it's, you know, this reserved nonsense doesn't apply. What's happened since then, of course, is the political composition of the board has changed under the Biden administration. And lo and behold, we have another NPRM that's now pending in which the current board says, we're going to unring the bell that was rung by the prior board. We're going to rescind that joint employer rule. And again, in simplistic terms, we're going to return to the standard that was under the Obama board of Browning-Ferris Industries. So there's a couple of things that I would just throw out there that I think are of interest in that context. First of all, it's important to remember that, you know, this notion of jointness is, you know, has a lot of its roots in liability law, where people are deemed to be jointly liable for a tort, for example. But jointness in the context of the National Labor Relations Act has far more meaning than merely assessing or allocating monetary liability. If you are, in fact, an employer under the National Labor Relations Act, you have affirmative duties on yourself. You have a duty, if your employees are represented, to bargain with that entity. So that, let me give you the example I think that scares a lot of people. Suppose it's black letter law that if I have an organized workforce and I decide to do something like move my business or change the nature of my business, and it results in the loss of work for members of the bargaining unit, I have at the very least a bargaining obligation with that entity, with the union representing those employees, to bargain about the effects of my decision to change my business operation and adversely affect those bargaining unit members. I may, in fact, have a decisional bargaining obligation where I have to sit with the union and talk about why I'm going to do this and whether I have good reason to do it. Well, what happens in this situation? Again, go back to the contractor for just a moment. The contractor contracts with the subcontractor and reserves those rights or reserves those kind of things about the contractor's employees that I mentioned. And then all of a sudden the contractor decides, you know, I really don't like my business-to-business relationship with this unionized contractor. Well, can they go out and just sever the business-to-business relationship? I mean, the argument is that they then have a bargaining obligation with the employees of the subcontractor. They have to bargain with that union to terminate their business-to-business contract, which is just a little bit mind-blowing, I think, to people, and certainly not something that, you know, it's the unintended consequence or maybe the intended consequence of what the BFI case does. The other thing I think that's important contextually is not only is there an affirmative duty to bargain for a joint employer also loses important protections under the National Labor Relations Act if they're deemed to be jointly employed. Again, let me give you the contractor-subcontractor relationship. Subcontractor is unionized and has a dispute with the union representing its employees. Well, if they are joint employers, these two, then the union can go over and picket employer A, even though employer A may have absolutely no control over the bargaining dispute between employer B and its employees. Nonetheless, they're stripped of their protection against being enmeshed in secondary activity by virtue of the fact that they're a statutory employer, according to the board, in terms of finding them to be a joint employer. So, I'll finish with just a couple of observations about this. And again, and I'm not sure the degree to which West Virginia versus EPA actually fits this issue. But when it comes to, you know, judicial skepticism and some of the undercurrents in the case, it sure fits in my mind. And I begin with this one. It strikes me as difficult to comprehend how one board can issue a rulemaking setting out a rubric for how you determine an essential issue, and less than 2 years later, another board comes along and upends that by 180 degrees, and there is no factual predicate for doing it. They haven't had enough experience under the current rule to say why they want to do this. The only thing that's changed is the political composition of the board. There's just a couple of other things, too, that I think that are worthy of mention in this context. Yep.
No, go ahead.
Yeah. The first is that the board has done no economic, they can't do any economic analysis of what this would cost the American economy. I would respectfully suggest that it's monumental. If you drag unwilling people into collective bargaining, it's going to cost. And there are also textual issues with this idea of joint employer. The phrase joint employer appears nowhere in the National Labor Relations Act, and in the relevant parts of the act, we always are using employer and the word employer in the singular, not in the plural. So that, and also there's an incongruity between the largest cohort of joint employers would probably be the federal government and state government, who are by statute excluded from the definition of employer. So it's a kind of illogical position. So with that, I'll close.
Stephen. Thank you. Good afternoon, everyone. Since I'm fourth on the panel, I thought I'll make 4 points. First, I was actually surprised by West Virginia versus EPA, not because of the outcome. I think the outcome is utterly unsurprising and absolutely correct. I was at the chamber and was the head of regulatory litigation when we brought the challenge to the Clean Power Plan, and I think the reasoning of the Supreme Court as to why the EPA doesn't have the authority to engage in the Clean Power Plan is absolutely correct. And it really fits with all of the precedent that came before it in King versus Burwell and Utility Air Regulatory Group and Brown and Williamson and all of these other cases that I guess today, after West Virginia versus EPA, are now regarded as sort of making up the major questions doctrine. But what I was surprised by was that the Supreme Court talked about it as if it was a thing, like a separate thing, a separate doctrine, as opposed to simply the way it previously had talked about it, which was as, you know, just sort of common sense statutory interpretation. So if I can start to join issue a little bit with my other members of the panel, I think I would disagree with Eric that it was a sea change in what the court was doing, but it certainly is a sea change in the way the court is talking about it. And it was certainly a sea change from the way the court talked about the issue in the NFIB versus OSHA case that came out in January, which I guess is point number two. And maybe my reason for being here is talking about how this doctrine affects OSHA and what OSHA does. And in the NFIB versus OSHA case, this was the challenge to the administration's vaccine or test mandate for private employers. So it was covering a huge swath of the American economy doing something that OSHA had never done before or thought it had the authority to do before in its 50-year history. And I think as you know, Brian had alluded to in the context of the NLRB, doing so under a statutory interpretation theory that had really no limiting principle to what OSHA couldn't regulate in the name of workplace safety. And so I think the Supreme Court, you know, came to a very clear and obvious conclusion. Six justices agreed that OSHA doesn't have the authority to regulate public health generally just because of the fortuity that the public health problem happens to arise in the workplace in addition to everywhere else in society. And I think one of the things that's important going forward as people are looking at different challenges to bring, regulations that might be vulnerable is, you know, this was a very risky regulatory move by the Biden administration to try to use what they thought was very broad authority from OSHA to do something. And not only did they lose their, you know, vaccine or test mandate, which, you know, would have been economically ruinous given the you know, labor shortages and supply chain problems that America was having at the, you know, holiday season when all of this litigation was occurring. You know, so they not only lost that particular regulatory tool, they also suffered a real major loss in front of the Supreme Court about what the Occupational Safety and Health Act means and what authority it does provide for OSHA to regulate things like, you know, heat exposure. Things where they're currently undergoing proposed rulemaking, and they're now going to face some serious, you know, vulnerability and litigation risk at a minimum in going forward with those other changes. So the third point I'll make, and it's related to the, you know, COVID vaccine context, is that both the NFIB versus OSHA and the West Virginia versus EPA decisions have pretty significant ramifications for the other vaccine, COVID-related regulations that are currently under challenge. Andre talked about OFCCP regulations. There are several different states and other groups that are challenging the contractor vaccine requirement, and, you know, all of those different challenges have succeeded so far in the 5th, 6th, 8th, 11th, I think even the 9th Circuit. So, you know, there's this pretty significant headwind that has developed against the administration's efforts to use long extant authority in you know, that case, the Procurement Act of 1949, to try to impose some public health regulation on the employees of government contractors. And the same could be said for the vaccine or test mandate that's being imposed on federal employees, which is also subject to regulation and multiple litigation in multiple different circuits, also facing the same sorts of challenges invoking the major questions doctrine. And so if I have a fourth and final point before turning over to Cheryl, I would say it's one of caution, which is that I think the key from, you know, this West Virginia versus EPA case is to make sure that, you know, it endures. I think, as I said in sort of my first point, I don't know that there really has been a sea change in the way that the Supreme Court approaches these types of statutory interpretation issues, because you could go back to Brown and Williamson, written by Justice Breyer, and other decisions where this sort of common sense point that where you've got a statute that's been around for a long time and nobody thought that it had the meaning that it had, you know, until today when the agency tries to invoke it to address some significant economic, social, political problem, we regard that skeptically. We think, really, is that really what Congress was doing in the 1970s when they enacted all of these, you know, vast panoply of labor, employment, you know, health and safety laws? Trying to make sure that that doesn't get caught up in what I think Justice Kagan, in her, you know, very strongly written dissent, labeled as sort of a new innovation, something that might seem more like a, you know, anti-government, you know, maybe Trumpian in its origins, given changes in compositions on the courts, kind of change, which won't endure. So I think if there's work to be done in how these are litigated and how courts decide these issues, it might actually be taking it away from some of the rhetoric of a sea change and making it back into, like, this is what courts have always done in terms of being skeptical of exercises of federal regulatory authority.
Thank you, Stephen. Cheryl.
Thank you. Thank you all for being here. If you're looking and saying, I saw an agenda online that it was going to be Tammy McCutchen, you're not going crazy. She sends her regrets, had a family matter. And so as I speak here today, if I say something profound that you like, I am channeling the esteemed administrator. If you don't like what I have to say, it's all my fault. But when I started reading through the West Virginia versus EPA decision, thinking about the wage and hour division, which, as you may or may not know, enforces about 15 different federal statutes. But the one that started it all is, of course, the Fair Labor Standards Act from the 1930s. And I was really interested in the fact that the majority really was probably most offended, felt like, as I was reading it, by the fact that this was a radical or fundamental change to an existing statutory scheme, that suddenly the EPA had, quote, discovered an unheralded power and transformative expansion in regulatory authority. And it really made me start thinking about, well, okay, some of these statutes, the FLSA and the Wage and Hour Division, go back to the 30s. There's clear authority to issue some regulations based on the Fair Labor Standards Act, and it really made me start thinking about the tail of the overtime rule. I thought about a bunch of different rules. We can debate them, but in the opening, I just want to focus on overtime. Many of you know the story of the overtime rule. The basis is if you work more than 40 hours in a week and you are a non-exempt employee, you get paid time and a half. So what's an exempt employee? Well, there's a whole slew of exemptions in the statute. The first and foremost that most people think of is the executive administrative procedure, professional exemption. Well, going back into the 40s, they began issuing regulations at the Wage and Hour Division with clear authority to issue regulations to define what duties make this that role this exemption. Well, one of the things the Wage and Hour did very early on was they decided to impose a duties test, but also put forth what they called a salary basis test that said, if you make this much money or less, there's no way you can ever meet the duties of one of these three exemptions, and you are by definition non-exempt. Of course, the challenge with that is that has to be, that number has to be increased over time to keep up with wages. So enter 2004, Administrator McCutcheon has the overtime rule that has not been really kind of updated or modernized in some time. And she's faced with a previous rule that has actually two tests. The long test, which was a lot, that went into the duties in a lot more detail. And with that long duties test was a much lower salary basis, $155 a week. Now by 2004, that was so under the federal minimum wage and had been for so long that test barely existed. Then there was the short duties test that was coupled with $255 a week, which was still above minimum wage. So what they did was they went through a very long rulemaking process, a lot of comments, a lot of analysis, and what they decided was they would merge the duties tests and they would issue one salary basis, and it was measured against the 20th percentile of the South Census and Retail Salaried Survey. Try saying that really fast. We'll get better at that as this goes by. And so that became the format for how you decide what the salary basis was, that again, if it was below that number, you don't even look at the duties test. You just assume that you know they are non-exempt because they're making such little money. Well, a decade goes by and that number doesn't get changed. And the Obama administration comes in and says, we need to change this. But they also go back and they say, well, she did away with the more important test. So what we're gonna do is we're gonna use her test of the duties test and not really change it. But we're gonna go to the 40th percentile of the South Census and Retail Salary Survey, and that's gonna be the number. And overnight, we went from about 455 a week to 913 a week. And I'm sure you guys may remember this. I mean, I was working in a state agency where the average wages were about $28,000 for managers. We were going through spreadsheet after spreadsheet on what we were gonna do with this rule. But the business community stepped in and sued in Texas and challenged the rule on a number of bases, obviously the APA. And the judge, in what may be a kind of interesting kind of forewarning of where this might go under the major question doctrine, really concluded in a large part that this couldn't be right because there were too many false positives. This salary basis test was now so high that the duties test essentially got written out of the statute, written out of the regulation, and all these people were gonna get swept in under the non-exempt status without really looking at whether their duties fell under this exemption. Trump administration comes in, I see a number of friends in the room. We worked together on issuing a new overtime rule in 2019. And what we did was we reverted back to the methodology the Wage and Hour Administration had done in 2004. We kept the duties test as it was in 2004, and we went back and updated the salary basis to what was the 20th percentile of the South Census and Retail Salaried Survey. Of course, now we're hearing that the Biden administration has an interest in reopening this rule and maybe trying to get back to the methodology that they did in the Obama administration, maybe with some more luck, or in some way raise this rule again. And this leads a number of questions to me under West Virginia versus EPA. First of all, now we have kind of an established methodology for setting that salary basis test. And if they find a new basis or a new argument for why that salary basis has to be suddenly changed, you know, is that just a traditional APA challenge, or is that something of a new power or a new, thing that they can do and upend the regulatory scheme? To me, though, what the more interesting question is, and I don't know where this comes down as I read these the decision and the concurrence and even the dissent, if you go back to the original statute, there's no mention of compensation in that exemption. And we know Congress knew how to write a compensation qualifier into exemptions for the Fair Labor Standards Act because it did it in 7i. So if it did it in one exemption but did not do it in the other exemption, is that a clear congressional power? But As I mentioned at the beginning, obviously what really, really concerns the majority was that it was a newfound power, that it was a new regulatory scheme, that it was something they suddenly did after decades. And so I think one of the big questions, especially, we can talk about some other regulations and how it might be analyzed from wage and hour under this decision, but are the courts gonna now start looking at things that have been in place for decades, but don't seem to have a statutory hook? To me, that's one of the really interesting next steps that I think, to Stephen's point, needs to be explored as challenges are brought to regulations.
Thank you, Cheryl. This is the period where the panelists will be able to comment on each other's remarks, including whether or not this decision is reverberating through the halls of Department of Labor, EEOC, and LRB. Who would like to start off? Sure, Eric.
So I feel like I have to respond to my friend Steve's critique of my remarks. Let me add, I agree in part with what Steve said, and I disagree respectfully in part. It is certainly the case that the Supreme Court has, in earlier cases, and those including the cases that Steve mentioned, reasoned in a similar fashion to declare an attempt by an agency at seizing new and unheralded powers over the economy as illegitimate or invalid. That's true, and to that extent, I agree with Steve. But what I think it would be a mistake, though, to read West Virginia versus EPA in isolation, or even read it along with the cases that it cites, without looking at what else is happening, both at the Supreme Court and in the lower courts. And I'm referring in particular, in part, about the non-delegation doctrine. We now have five justices, a majority, who have said they are ready, three of whom were willing to do it in a case 3 years ago, a fourth who said he's willing to do it in another case, and a fifth who said the same thing, or nearly the same thing, to revive a doctrine that's been dead since 1935. And we also have, even this month, within the last month, U.S. Court of Appeals for the Fifth Circuit essentially declaring that an entire federal agency essentially is wholly illegitimate in everything it does because the funding mechanism violates the Apportionments Clause. This is a new approach. Now, the Apportionments Clause goes back to the original Constitution. The non-delegation doctrine is not new, but it's been dead for 85 or more years, and 87 years since the court has done anything with it. And so, and both of these, I think, are getting at different things. One of them, I think, is a message, the non-delegation doctrine, to the Congress. And the same thing with the Fifth Circuit's decision about the CFPB. Congress, we now are going to look more carefully at how you're drafting statutes because we don't like agencies doing whatever they want. We live in a democracy, and in a democracy, the Congress of the United States is supposed to be enacting the laws that govern our people, not agencies. So I just want to make that point. Secondly, if you listen to what Cheryl said, it reminds me back when I served as Tammy McCutcheon's deputy at the Wage and Hour Division at the Labor Department in 2002, 2003, when we were drafting the white-collar exemption regulations that Cheryl described. Tammy came up with a methodology. The Obama administration had a different methodology. Cheryl adopted Tammy's methodology. But what's the common theme here? The common theme is you have unelected executive branch officials essentially just making things up. There was no, as Cheryl said, there's nothing in the Fair Labor Standards Act that says a single word about how much executive, administrative, and professional employees are supposed to be paid. Instead, what we've created with this administrative state is we've created a system in which unelected bureaucrats, and I've served in that role myself, but unelected bureaucrats essentially just make things up that are completely untethered to statutes enacted by Congress. And I think what the Supreme Court said in the West Virginia case, I think what Justice Gorsuch's dissent said in Gundy is, this kind of government is not consistent with the Constitution of the United States. The Constitution is structured in a manner both to create a government that functions well, but to preserve our liberty by functioning properly. And that is, the legislative power is enumerated, it's limited and enumerated, and it can only be done by one body, the Congress of the United States. They can't delegate it away, and the agencies can't enact laws that govern us the way Congress is supposed to do. That is totally antithetical to the kind of republic we think we live in.
Steve and or Cheryl, any response?
So, So I think also, you know, what Brian talked about, what I talked about with the overtime story, the companion care exemption story, which we can talk about, really does highlight this idea that we see a lot of flip-flopping, right? You see that when you have a new someone come into office on the in the presidency and you have new political officials come in, you end up, if there isn't a better kind of guiding principle of when rules can be upended and kind of turned on their ear, whether it's, you know, going into Browning-Ferris, whether it is doubling the overtime salary basis test, assuming that's valid, overnight, whether it is, you know, changing the companion care exemption statute on a dime, what is the guiding principle there? And I think that this is fascinating to me because about 5 or 8 years ago, I found myself, when people would come to me and say, okay, President Trump has gone into office, what, you know, is the court going to overturn Roe v. Wade? And I said to them, the question you should be asking yourself is this court going to change the administrative state? Because that's going to have a lot more day-to-day impact on your life, because you don't think about all of the regs that every day are being pushed out by the executive branch with very little principles or oversight or recourse. I mean, now we do have the Congressional Review Act, but, you know, and without a lot of recourse, and they're doing it constantly, and that's having way more impact on what you do day in and day out, whether it's at your job, how your work is structured, you know, any of this. And so I think this is a really impactful an inflection point on where are we going to go with administrative law. I see, I think I saw a new Civil Liberties Alliance, one of my classmates from law school here, really pushing this non-delegation doctrine to make us think twice on how do we make sure that there are some parameters and guideposts put in so that the administrative state just doesn't take over the legislative function.
So you had asked if the decision is reverberating through the halls, and I think it certainly is, of all of these agencies. I know with OSHA, you know, the NFIB versus OSHA decision was reverberating in the halls. The administration sort of gambled with OSHA's regulatory power and lost, and agencies don't like to lose their regulatory power. Probably everybody in this room would agree with that, and everybody on the panel who'd served in an agency, you don't like to give up what you have while you're there, at least. But I think that's true across the entire executive branch. If they're not looking at these decisions, then, you know, they're likely to do things that will cause them to then lose in court and, again, suffer the same sort of reduction in regulatory power that you saw for OSHA and EPA. I think when it comes to the non-delegation doctrine, I don't know if there are 5 votes. Eric, you'll be proven right or wrong, I suppose, over time. I guess I'm not sure if there are 5 votes on that. One thing I've always wondered about the non-delegation doctrine, though, is I'm not entirely sure why it's actually a way to limit the size or power of the administrative state. Imagine if the wage and hour division or the OSHA part that actually writes the regulations, imagine they were congressional agencies. No delegation, right? Perfectly fine for Congress to say, okay, here's what the rule is, and now we've got this OSHA that, instead of being an executive branch agency, is a congressional Article I agency, and they're going to fill in the details for us here. I'm not sure that there's a separation of powers problem. I'm not sure that there's been any reduction in what role the federal government would have over the American economy. So, you know, that obviously would require a lot of fiat and waving of wands for that to happen, but I've never been convinced that it's actually like a talisman to be able to limit the scope of the administrative state.
I trust these comments have engendered some questions from our audience. Feel free to line up at the microphones if you have a question. There are 3 rules as moderator I'm gonna invoke. First, please give your name and affiliation. Second, if you give a long preface, we need to move from a declarative sentence to an interrogative sentence at some juncture. And then if there's a particular speaker to whom you're addressing the question, please feel free to let them know at the beginning. If it's to the full panel, let the full panel know. Sir.
Thank you. My name is Craig Lean. I'm a partner at K&L Gates, and I was a former OFCCP director as well, and I was Andre's senior advisor. I know a lot of people on the panel. Eric, I have a question for you. It seems like, you know, you spoke very eloquently about the role of Congress and elected officials and the non-delegation doctrine, but it seems to me that the logical extension of your position is that the Administrative Procedures Act is unconstitutional. Is that your position?
I think if we were riding on a blank slate, I think we would have to consider that question. I mean, let's think about it. The legislative power under the Constitution is vested in one entity, the Congress. Yet we've created this whole structure of legislative rules that have the force and effect of law. How is that consistent with Article I of the Constitution? I think there's a serious question as a matter of first principles. Now, we are 70 years or thereabouts into the Administrative Procedure Act, and I don't think the Supreme Court is ready to declare the Administrative Procedure Act unconstitutional as a predictive matter. I think that's unlikely to happen. But I think in terms of originalism and properly understanding Article I of the Constitution, I think there are serious questions about it.
Andre?
One of the things that, I don't know, can you hear me?
No.
You cannot? Okay. Okay, so now you can. So look at Executive Order 11246 by LBJ in 1965. So then is that 57 years old? I mean, some laws don't last that long, and it's still, I mean, isn't it really in effect a law at this point? I mean, do you see anyone in the near future overriding Executive Order 11246? I mean, what president's gonna take that on and say, hey, I'm the one that got rid of the non-discrimination doctrine? I mean, so it really is a law, and it wasn't passed by Congress. The reason why you can pass executive orders is because you can do it quickly, and it should be inherent in them that they are temporary. 57 years is not temporary, and I don't think anyone here sees it going away anytime soon. I mean, isn't that troubling?
I do think we do need to think about how this applies to executive orders. I don't necessarily want to take that one on, but I think about the executive order that all federal contractors have to pay $15 across the country. Well, Davis-Bacon and Service Contract Act are the statutes that Congress passed that told the administrative state, that told the executive, that you were to set prevailing wages. And I went back and I looked this morning, and indeed, the prevailing wages in the Davis-Bacon Act are defined as work similar to the kind of contract work in the civil subdivision of the state in which the work is performed or the District of Columbia. So here we have the president mandating a $15 minimum wage for all federal contractors, but then we have statutes and directives from Congress saying that these prevailing wages are based on geography. And so I question, and you know, this is going a little off, but how far will this major question doctrine go, and how far does it extend to administrative actions like executive orders?
Sure. The New Civil Liberties Alliance, my understanding was that the Oracle lawsuit that they were defending against OFCCP did bring executive order 11246 called it into question, and certainly the NCLA's amicus brief in that case called executive order 11246 into question. So if someone else wants to sue on that, get in touch with me. My question is for Steve Lhotsky on the non-delegation doctrine, which is on your last point about the sort of, do you lose the oomph on it if you just move them into legislative agencies? I would have thought that a legislative agency can't directly impact citizens, and that the concern we have with administrative agencies isn't so much which branch of government they're in, but whether or not they're affecting citizens directly without the authority to do so. And so I would love to see agencies moved into the legislative branch if that means they can no longer violate civil liberties the way that they're doing on a daily basis.
I'm not so sure. That's right. I mean, there's the Copyright Office, which is part of the Library of Congress, you know, clearly an Article One entity, and the, you know, Copyright Office sets like royalty rates for music publishers and writers. So I don't know if there's ever been a constitutional challenge to the Copyright Office. Maybe somebody wants to look into that. I don't know.
Right?
What's that?
The claim would be that this legislative agency was engaging in executive power or executive action if it were doing something directly against citizens.
Well, but I thought the whole argument of the non-delegation doctrine is it's exercising legislative power.
But you can't do either one.
I think of executive power as enforcing the law, right? Is Article 2, the president has the power to, you know, take care that the law shall be faithfully executed. So if you've got Congress or a congressional agency making the laws and then the executive enforcing them, that's the way our system is supposed to work. I think Eric's exactly right about the separation of powers implications, but maybe it just means that Congress should be much, much bigger and the executive should be much, much smaller and just limited to doing the kinds of things like maybe the NLRB typically does of adjudication and enforcement.
Thanks.
We have time for one more question.
Sir.
Hi, Matthew Mimnaw. I'm a counsel for the U.S. Senate. My question is directed to the panel about worker classification. Given the 21st century issues we have now with the gig economy, Administrator Stanton, under her tenure, issued a worker classification rule emphasizing two factors of the economic realities test. DOL just issued a new rule saying they're going to emphasize all six factors now, which, when applied, could, in essence, classify a number of independent contractors as employees. So my question is, given the fact that Schechter is still good law, given the fact that Panama Refining Company is still good law, and given the implications of that application on the economy, is there a good legal argument for reviving the non-delegation doctrine just based on that? Or do you all believe that under the FLSA, there is sufficient authority for the administrator to selectively apply the six-factor economic realities test to suit political goals?
I've thought a lot about this, as Matt notes, and again, a number of people in this room were of great assistance in issuing that independent contractor rule, and it was the first time we had done rulemaking at the Wage and Hour Division on independent contractor and since the statute was written. And so some question there about a new power, did we have authority, things of that nature. But if you look at what we did in that rule, and I don't know which way this cuts, but if you look at what we did in that rule, there's a sixth factor. One of the six factors is the work integral to the business or the putative employer? I raise that because if you go back to the original Supreme Court decision in the 1940s, Rutherford Foods, where it talks about what's an employee under the FLSA versus not, that is the original of where people pull this elusive six-factor test out of, it's talking about, it's a chicken plant, it's a poultry plant. And one of the factors they look at is if the plucker, who was the, is he an independent contractor or not, gets pulled off the line, can the line still operate? Was he integrated into the line of work such that the work couldn't happen without him and it was him? I say that because the ABC test, the B, is like it goes to that concept of integral. Not is it, you know, let's talk about freelance journalists. They hate being classified as employees. They all kind of lost, I shouldn't say they all, many of them objected because they lost work, because they stopped freelance journalism in California when AB 5 was passed. And, you know, they are integral to the business because they were writing articles that the the news outlet was putting out, but they weren't integrated in the process. Similarly, how far does this go? If you have a freelance graphic designer, well, it's integral that you have in your marketing materials pictures and on your website. Does that make you integrated into the line of production? So anyway, I say all that to say that one of the things we really teased out in that rule was this idea of what was Rutherford Foods originally saying in the 40s. And so I really wonder how the major question doctrine would apply in that situation, where what you have is a rule that's trying to go back to the basics, go back to the beginning and say, where did this start? What was it supposed to be? And how has it been knocked off course over time?
Well, as Chief Judge Breyer said this morning, debate is not dead. It lives at the Federal Society. I hope you've enjoyed our panel today, and please join me in thanking them.